So welcome to today's Common Spirit Health Grand Rounds. I'm very excited today. We're going to be talking about cutting-edge new therapies and management for sickle cell disease. And we have an amazing group of guests. So I'm going to try to get right to this. I'm going to just open up quickly, by saying I've been treating patients suffering from sickle cell my entire medical career and have been extremely frustrated with our lack of progress in therapy for patients. While we knew exactly what the genetic issues were, our ability to make significant progress has been quite, limited. And so having this opportunity is very exciting, obviously, for me and for the whole community. So we are here to talk about it and think about how does Common Spirit fit into this new era of therapy. So let me just get right to it. I'm going to introduce our four speakers, we'll jump right. Dr. Ankita Sagar is here today, as you all know. She's Associate Professor at Creighton University and our Vice President for Clinical Standards. New to us is Dr. Mark Uden, who is a professor at the Baylor College of Medicine. He did his education at the University of Texas Southwestern, internship, residency, and fellowship, all at the Baylor College of Medicine. He is a professor there and chief of the Benign Hematology Service, and a long-standing history of research, education, and care for sickle cell. Back with us is Father Kevin Fitzgerald, who is a Jesuit Catholic priest. He has his PhD in molecular genetics, his PhD in bioethics. He may have another PhD that I'm unaware of. He is the John A. Creighton University Professor and Chair of the Department of Medical Humanities at Creighton University School of Medicine. Now, our very special guest today that I'm most excited about, sorry, Kevin and Mark, but is Miss Victoria Gray. She's a wife and a mother of four from Forest, Mississippi, who became the first patient to receive a CRISPR-based therapy for sickle cell disease through XCell therapy trial in 2019. She is now symptom-free and working as a patient advocate and international speaker to spread the word about CRISPR and the treatment for sickle cell. We are so happy to have you with us today. And our panel leader today that we'll be having after our discussions is the one and only Dr. Nana Coleman, who serves as our System Senior Vice President for Academic and Faculty Affairs at Common Spirit Health. And she is an Associate Professor of Pediatrics at the Baylor College of Medicine. She has many, many other accolades, but we have little time to go through them. So I'm going to hand this off to Dr. Sagar to go over kind of a big picture of what's happening with sickle cell in terms of prevalence. Thank you.
Thanks, Dr. McGinn. So I wanted to have a little bit of baseline of when we think about sickle cell disease specifically, what is the perspective? How much is this affecting our patients and our communities across multiple different levels? So I'm going to walk us through a quick journey on starting at the global level, then we'll go to the national level, Common Spirit Health, and then, of course, our very, very important patient perspective of this. So on the next slide, let's get to the global narrative. So about 7.74 million people across the globe as of 2021 are living with sickle cell disease. Pretty significant. And on the next slide, I just want us to appreciate a little bit about how difficult this data is to actually receive and process, partly because you can tell multiple nations have started to pool their data together to really inform the global burden of disease. This study was from 2021, published in Lancet Hematology. And we can see that there is a large prevalence based on this data within the African continent, Middle East, maybe a little bit of South Asia. But what this data is not able to tell us is the accuracy of what we're missing, because data like this is really hard to get. But this is an estimate of, on the top, where it says birth incidence, how many babies in 2021 were born per 100,000 with sickle cell disease. And then on the bottom right corner, it tells us all age prevalence, males and females in 2021 per 100,000 people. So globally, very prevalent. It is therefore a really important consideration when we think about why we are here to talk about treatment. And on the next slide, I want to talk about the US narrative, which really is informed only partially with the US-based data that has been sifted through the CDC, and this is an estimate. About 100,000 people living in the US have sickle cell disease, likely an underestimate by most accounts. Now, when we think about births, about one out of every 365 Black or African American birth babies would be having sickle cell disease, and about one out of every 16,000 Hispanic American birth babies would be having sickle cell disease. But what's even further important to understand is the sickle cell trait, and I'm sure both Dr. Uden and Father Fitzgerald will go into the genetics of this, because sickle cell is a recessive gene. So it's important to understand the prevalence of the trait itself. About 3 million persons in the US as of 2020 had sickle cell trait. Therefore, future genealogies can be affected. And about 1 in 13 African American babies are born with sickle cell trait, therefore fairly prevalent when you think about it. This data, again, is very scarce and scant because only 7 states currently report to the CDC any sort of surveillance of sickle cell disease. So part of the consideration in all of this work is also how are we capturing data and able to really make sure outcomes improve over time. And then when it comes to Common Spirit Health on the next slide, I want us to think about how often are we really seeing sickle cell disease within our adult patients across the footprint of our ministry. So since 2019, so give or take 5 years, Common Spirit Health has seen about 5,290 adults with sickle cell disease. Now, these folks may come in through our EDs or in our inpatient facilities or our ambulatory surgery centers, but also through our ambulatory offices. And what we mean by that is really that primary care visit or the visit to their hematologist. And that's about 787 patients that do come in for preventive care visits within Common Spirit Health over the last 5 years. But I think the most biggest highlight is really the patient story, which is the next slide. And I'm so excited to hand the floor off to Ms. Gray to really share her narrative and what her journey has been.
Good morning, everyone. I'm so happy to be here to share my story with you guys. So I want to start by telling you guys about when I got diagnosed. I received my diagnosis at the age of 3 months, and that was also around the same time I had my first crisis. My mom, it was just a typical day. She was preparing me for bed, and she gave me a warm bath. And as she was taking me out, I just began to cry. She couldn't console me, so she wondered what was going on. Her first thought was that I was crying because the doctors dislocated my shoulder during birth and maybe she re-injured it. So she took me to the ER, and that's when they told her that I was having a sickle cell crisis, and they also gave her the news that I would only live with her for 7 years, if that. So she received heartbreak that night, just expecting something to be minor, and she got this dreadful diagnosis for her daughter. And after that diagnosis, my life consisted of hospital stays, clinic visits, blood transfusions, pain medicine. My first crisis that I was old enough to remember was preschool. That would put me about the age of 4 years old. I had a good day at school, learning and playing, but I was excited to come home, get out of my clothes, and go next door to my best friend's house, Candace, so we can run around in the yard. But when I arrived home and I began to get undressed to change into my play clothes, I started having a sharp pain down one of my arms. It was sharp and achy, and it traveled like lightning across my chest down my other arm. And before I knew it, in a matter of minutes, my entire body was consumed with pain. I fell to the floor and I called for my grandmother. And all I could do was cry. My grandmother, she followed the routine that my hematologist had gave her. She tried the warm towels. She tried to rub me down. She gave me my pain medicine, which was Tylenol 3 at the time. She even prayed, but nothing worked. We had to travel to the ER, which was over an hour away from our home. And I had to go in the hospital for over a week and receive IV fluids, blood transfusion, and morphine. And as a kid, I could recover after a week and maybe another 2 days, and I would go back to school and try to be normal. But I never knew when my next crisis was going to flare up again. So as a kid, I was having sickle cell crisis about every 6 months, twice a year, until I made it to high school. And once I arrived at high school and my body started to change, I grew into a woman with menstrual cycles. That affected my crisis. So that would take me to the ER pretty much once a month. And sometimes I could get IV fluids and pain medicines and be okay. And other times I had to go in for long stays, which was now 2 weeks at a time. And that was hard for me to deal with, being a young adult in school, in high school, because I wanted to participate in activities. I wanted to be a cheerleader. My doctor told me I couldn't do that. I wanted to play basketball. My doctor told me I couldn't do that because any exertion would send me into crisis. So being a kid, I still tried to remain hopeful, even though I had all the no's. But it began to wear on me by the time I made it to college. I went to college to pursue a nursing career. Well, when I first started, I wanted to be a heart doctor. But as they went over and gave me the rundown of how long that would take, I kind of shrunk within myself, knowing that would be an impossible task for me. Because of the stress and number of classes, my body just couldn't hold up. I knew the extra stress would cause more crisis for me. So I moved on to the RN program. But before I could finish the RN program, I had one of the worst crises of my life. It happened in October while we was out on fall break. And this particular crisis, it took away my ability to use my arms at all. I couldn't use my legs. I had to go to the bathroom on myself because the pain was too severe for me to lift up my hips to even get on a bedpan. And being so young and having to completely depend on someone else for your care around the clock, it crushed me. I stayed in the hospital from that last week in October, and I didn't get out until the second week in January. I had received rehabilitation to regain the use of my arms, to be able to lift up a fork to feed myself. I had to be on a walker with them having a belt around my waist because my legs weren't strong enough for me to stand and I was off balance. Just to learn how to walk again so I could go home to at least now just be a mother. I gave up the dream of college and nursing and that I could be anything more in life. So I went home just to be a mom, and I got married, and things were okay, but I knew I had gave up a lot of dreams. I didn't really feel like Victoria anymore. And after that hospital stay, no more than about 2 years later, I got an infection in my port. And after that infection, my body really crashed. It put me in a place where I had to have complete in-home care, where I couldn't even wash my own hair anymore. I couldn't give myself a bath anymore, couldn't do laundry. I couldn't make meals for my husband or my children. I was only existing. This went on for about a period of 5 years, and I just felt myself fading. What my wake-up call was when my son's teacher, she called me. She said, "I need to meet with you because all your children are acting different, but I'm really concerned about Jamarius. He's constantly getting in trouble and he's acting out, and we're tired of suspending him because he needs to be in school. So I just want to have a meeting to talk to you." So my aide got me ready and helped me go to the school, and she sat me down and she said, "I know why Jamarius is acting out." And she said, "It's because he thinks you're gonna die. So he wants to be at home just in case you pass away." That was crushing. And the thing was, I knew it was true because I felt that I was gonna die. But I thought no one would care. I thought I wasn't being a good mom. But hearing how my kids' behavior had already changed, and I wasn't even dead yet, I knew I had to fight. I had to fight for them to be here. So I started back researching my disease. But my cousins ended up sending me an article of a young woman from Chicago who had a haplotransplant, and she was better. I think her mom was her donor. Soon enough, my next crisis was flare, and I would be in the hospital again. In this hospital stay, I had a ketamine infusion in one arm, the Dilaudid being pumped in the other, and I still had no pain relief. I was still bedbound with pain everywhere. So I was tired. I called the head hematologist in. I called the hospitalist that was treating me in, the nurses from the floor in, and I told them that I knew I couldn't live like this anymore. I told them about the haplotransplant that I had heard about, and I asked them had they heard about anything that can help me get out of bed. They looked at one another, and then they looked back at me, and they said, "No, we don't know anything about that, and we don't have anything besides what we're doing." So that made me feel completely hopeless. But as I got out the hospital and I came back home, I went to God in prayer and I asked God, "Can you give me something just for me to live long enough to see my children grow up, get married, and be independent so where they won't need me anymore? If you would just let me live long enough to do that, I would be satisfied with my life." In less than 30 days, I got a call from my hematologist. She said, "Victoria, I have some good news for you, but I want to tell you in office because it's that good. I don't want to tell you over the phone." So that made me excited. I went to see Dana that January of 2018, and she told me that a doctor from Nashville named Dr. Frangoul had reached out to her to see if she had any patients that wanted to do the haplotransplant. So she immediately thought of me because she knew I was giving up, but still wanting to fight for my kids. So I traveled to Nashville to meet Dr. Frangoul together with my husband and my brother, who was set to be my donor because we had the same mother and father. So I met Dr. Frangoul. He explained haplotransplant to me. His spirit was great. And my brother and I, we began to do the testing to see if he would be a suitable match for me for the transplant. And he was. So we started the process and all the testing that need to be done. Some testing I could do here in Mississippi, like my lung test and my heart test, and some I had to go to Nashville to do was the collection of my bone marrow and things like that. When I was in Nashville, I ended up having another severe crisis that was heartbreaking to me. So I was stuck there for another 2 weeks. At that time, that's when Dr. Frangoul, he sat at my bedside and he presented CRISPR option to me. He asked me and my husband, had we ever heard of CRISPR? And I said no because it was new. And he gave me a video, but how he explained it to me was that it was like going into a textbook with thousands of words, finding a word that was misspelled or incorrect, and just flipping the switch to change that word without disrupting the other words around it. So I had two questions for him. My first question was there a risk of graft versus host disease, because that's what I feared with the transplant with my brother, was rejection and having a disease that I wouldn't know how to handle. And he told me no, there was no chance, because what CRISPR would do, they would take my own cells out, do the edit, and give me my own cells back. So my body wouldn't attack itself. It would recognize the cell. They would be the same cells, just with the edit. And because he told me I would be the first person, I wanted to know if it didn't work, did I still have options? Could I still do the transplant as planned with my brother? And he gave me that yes, that I could still do the transplant with my brother. I will only have to wait a year to see if it the graft took or if it failed. So that gave me everything I need. It took away the fear of graft versus host disease. And that was the reason that I was hesitant. So it felt like, to me, an answer from God. So I gave Dr. Frangou my yes. And after a few months, I did the cell collection. They sent the cell off to the lab. I came back once the cells were ready, got 3 days of chemo. And on July 2nd, 2019, I received my new cells that I call my super cells. Dr. Frangou, with just 3 vials and a quick push, that transformed my life that day. I didn't feel any difference physically, but I just knew something was happening, because I felt this was God's way of giving me the miracle I had prayed for since childhood. But after about 3 months, I noticed I didn't have to receive any more blood transfusions. After the initial chemo, I did receive one blood transfusion for the platelets. But after that, I didn't even have to get the other blood transfusions that Dr. Frangou thought I would. But then I had a moment after the chemo. I got the mouth sores. I experienced weakness. But the mouth sores was the most horrible part for me, because I couldn't eat. And I had one pill that they couldn't substitute via IV. So I had to swallow it. And that pill felt like I was swallowing glass. So it was horrific. But I had my dad there to reassure me during the times where I felt bad and cried, that I had seen worse, because I had. And I knew I was here now for a bigger purpose. So things progressed. I got out of the hospital. I was able to come back home to Mississippi. And the embrace I got from my children when I got here is indescribable. Just to see their tears and joy, just to see me and accept me with my bald head and my new look, it was life-changing for all of us. The first thing I recognized was an increase in energy. I wasn't as tired as I was. But then I had to go through withdrawal. Dr. Frangou and I decided that I wanted to do the taper to come off of the medicine. COVID had happened, so the world was shut down. We began the taper and everything was okay. But then my pharmacy couldn't get the fentanyl patch to do that taper. So I had to go cold turkey. That's when I began again with body aches, sweats, anxiety. And that lasted for about a month and a half. But one great day, I woke up. I felt absolutely nothing. I thought I was dead. I began to pinch my face, my thighs. But I felt that pain, but I didn't feel anything else. For reassurance, I called my kids in the room, because I just wanted to see them, to see if I was alive. So I called them in and they all ran in like, "Mama, what's wrong?" I said, "Nothing. I just wanted to see you guys. So good morning. You can go on now." That was my realization that my life was different. The pain was gone. The fatigue was gone. I didn't feel nothing. That it was normal felt like. I hadn't experienced that feeling in all my life. And I was just in shock for a moment, but I accepted it and things changed. I began jumping outside on the trampoline with my children. I didn't have to go to the hospital, ERs anymore. I was done with fentanyl. I was done with the Dilaudid. I was done with oxycodone. I now didn't depend on any medications when I got up, any medications when I went to bed. I was just a normal person. After a year, I decided to get out the house and get a job. So now I work full time. I travel internationally to speak, and I work here at Walmart. I'm a full time mom. I don't miss anything, you guys. My life is no longer full of no's, it's full of yeses. I can travel and do what I please. I can be a wife to my husband and travel with him and support him through his military career. I get to live and thrive in this life and not just exist. Thank you guys for listening to my story.
Well, thank you for that amazing story. I mean, as a person who's taking care of sickle cell patients, it's really gratifying to hear that kind of transformation. And I'm glad that it worked for you. So now I get a rather mundane job of talking about the pathophysiology of sickle cell disease and how our understanding of sickle cell has led to these new treatments. So I can have the next slide. I have a long interest in sickle cell disease. I gave my first grand rounds at Baylor as an attending in 1983. And I talked mostly about the pathophysiology because, as you can see from this slide, we didn't have a lot to offer in terms of treatment. So our management in 1983 included narcotics for pain, oxygen fluids, a transfusion, and exchange transfusion. We offered penicillin prophylaxis, but a key development, newborn screening, had not yet been implemented in Texas. It came to us in 1985. And that probably was the first thing that actually made life different for sickle cell patients, because now they didn't have to find out at age 3 months or 6 months that they had the disease. It could be detected at birth, and the parents could be forewarned and given a plan to take care of the babies. So there wasn't much going on in 1983 in terms of treatment. Next slide. Now, our understanding of sickle cell disease begins in 1910 with a paper by James Herrick, who described a young dental student who was attending dental school in Chicago. And he was from the island of Grenada, and he was admitted to the hospital with what I think we would now call chest syndrome. He was seen by an intern, Dr. Irons, who did an examination of his blood because he was anemic. And he noticed the presence of these peculiar elongated cells, which we now call sickle cells. The patient got better on his own and was followed by Dr. Herrick for a year or two. When he finished dental school, he went back to Granada and died suddenly about 10 years later. But he had a good existence there and practiced dentistry. Next slide. So in the next 40 years, or 50 years after 1910, the first thing I think people recognized was the sickling phenomenon. And that is the hemoglobin S, when it's deoxygenated, tends to form a crystal, which then deforms the cell into its characteristic sickle shape. And after multiple transformations between oxy and deoxy hemoglobin as the cells circulate, the cells become permanently deformed into that sickle shape, and they become vulnerable to shear stress, and they break down and cause a hemolytic anemia, but they also compromise blood flow so that you have problems with organ perfusion. Now, the next step was to identify the change in the molecule, the protein that causes this, and this was done by Dr. Vernon Ingram at the Cavendish Laboratory, and he was first to identify an amino acid change at the sixth position from glutamine to valine, and this established sickle cell disease as the first molecular disease of human protein. And that was in 1956, and here I was presenting in 1983. And with all this information, there was not much to show in terms of treatment. Now, we do have a treatment, now Voxelotor, which is a drug which stabilizes the oxyform of the hemoglobin S molecule and therefore retards its ability to sickle. And that's an important advance that's been made recently. The sickling process also depends on the oxygen, the oxidation status of the red blood cell. And a very simple additive of an amino acid L-glutamine appears to improve that oxidation status. And so that is another FDA-approved therapy that we have for the disease based on this physiology. Next slide. Well, we were fortunate here at Baylor to do some work with adhesion. But it turns out that sickle cells adhere to endothelial cells, and that's one of the reasons they cause damage. And our work showed that it was actually not the sickle cells that were doing the damage, but the very young red blood cells or reticulocytes that were very sticky. And they seemed to adhere to the endothelial membrane, and then they would retard the flow of the sickle cells, and then that would cause the problem. The cells would reside in the vessel too long, become deoxygenated, and cause problems. So one of the things that comes out of that research is the idea that if you can inhibit adhesion of white cells, especially, you can improve things. And so we do have an FDA-approved treatment based on that hypothesis, and that is crizanlizumab. And that has come into some problems recently. There's been some difficulty in showing its efficacy, but we all have some patients who seem to do very much better with a monthly infusion of this drug, which inhibits P-selectin, which mediates this adhesion event. So that is a third treatment that we have for sickle cell disease based on pathophysiology. Next slide. Now, just to remind you kind of the basic features of the disease, Ms. Gray has told you a great deal in her own experience about what happens. And one of the things that we can say is that we have an anemia. We have the hallmark cell that we can see in the blood, the sickle cell. And we have two basic processes that are going on. One is a microvascular disease, which is silent. And that is, it whittles away at certain circulations first. So the spleen is first to go. And once the spleen is gone, there's a susceptibility to particular infections, such as pneumococcal. You get pulmonary hypertension as people get into their 30s and 40s. We see end-stage kidney disease, and we see hepatic insufficiency. Now, what Ms. Gray presented to you is a rather terrible problem of sickle pain. And the terrible part of it is they have sickle cell disease all the time, but pain is intermittent and unheralded. They never know what's going to happen. And so some patients are affected more than others. About 80% of our patients have a crisis. A pain crisis may be once a year or less, but 20% have much more frequent disease, and it's debilitating. Other acute events that can be life-threatening are chest syndrome, where we lose circulation in the lung. Of all places, you'd think sickle would be happiest in the lung where there's oxygen, but it turns out there is shunting in the lung, and you can get these chest syndromes, which can be very devastating, and it's one of the common causes of death in a sickle cell patient. Youngsters are prone to strokes, and we have methods for detecting who's at risk, and we can place patients on a transfusion program to prevent that. Splenic disease sometimes is acute instead of a chronic process, and we have acute splenic sequestration, and you can lose a baby that way. And then some patients have more widespread sickling, and it causes multi-organ failure syndrome. I think there is some overlap here with the slide, but newborn screening comes in, and mothers and fathers are warned not to just treat a fever with Tylenol. They're taught to bring their kids in for cultures and antibiotics. They're also taught to examine the abdomen when they think there's colic, to make sure it's not the spleen. With newborn screening, we saw a definite improvement. If you look at data from Jamaica, before newborn screening, the a child reaching the age of 16 or 17 only about 70% of sickle cell kids did that. After screening and penicillin prophylaxis, we saw more like 80, and with more modern care, about 95% of kids reach the age of 18 in this country. Next slide. Now, we talk about sickle cell disease. There are actually several different forms to consider. One is not a disease, that's a sickle trait. And we were informed at the top of the show that there are 3 million people in the US with sickle trait. It's about 8%. And it doesn't really shorten half-life lifespan, but there are some problems, particularly with exercise, that people are aware of. But the real disease is hemoglobin SS, a homozygous condition, and it has an incidence of about 1 in 400. We have a related condition, sickle beta thalassemia, where you have a sickle gene that works and another gene that doesn't do anything at all. So for practical purposes, you just have the sickle. And that's about 10% of people, but hemoglobin SS and hemoglobin sickle beta thalassemia are usually put together, and they're the focus of trials, and they are the focus of the current trials in gene editing and gene replacement or insertion. SC disease is another form of sickle cell. C hemoglobin is prevalent in West Africa. And I should mention C trait and S trait. Individuals are protected against malaria when they're in the age of 1 to about 3. And this accounts for its prevalence. Malaria is a devastating illness in Africa. So sickle trait has increased in the population to protect young kids from that disease. Hemoglobin SC disease is kind of like sickle cell light, although some patients have just as bad of problems as homozygous patients. And the problem here is that for this disease and sickle beta plus thalassemia, they make up about a third of the patients, but there isn't any special effort. Well, there hasn't been any real effort to provide treatment for them. Treatment has been focused on the homozygous condition. Crizanlizumab did seem to show a positive benefit for SC, and that's the first time we've had a treatment that seems to be beneficial for them. Next slide. Now, life expectancy. A lot of my patients kind of were surprised to find themselves alive at 30. You know, they had been told that they were going to be dead before they were 7, just like Miss Gray. But the fact is, they do have a shortened lifespan. And the most recent data is from 2023, and it's aggregate data from big data sets. And it looks at all kinds of sickle cell disease, including the milder conditions. And the life expectancy is 53 years. So people have their life expectancy shortened by about 20 years. And this is something that needs to be factored in when you think about curative therapy. Now, the causes of death are now being seen mostly in adults, because kids get to be adults now, and it's usually organ failure. Renal transplant is needed sometimes, hepatic failure occurs, and then there's the problem with pulmonary hypertension. Next slide. Now, another feature of hemoglobin is that it switches. At the bottom, you can see our adult hemoglobins, hemoglobin A, hemoglobin A2, and hemoglobin F. Hemoglobin F is the principal fetal hemoglobin. And as you can see from this time graph, that the gamma chain, which is determines fetal hemoglobin, is prevalent during most of development, but is shut down around the third trimester. And it switched over to the beta chain. The beta chain, if it has a mutation like S, or it doesn't work like we see in thalassemia, those patients don't present with problems until they're 3 to 6 to 9 months old. So the value of there is a newborn screening. You can detect that. Now, the other value of this is that maybe we could treat sickle cell or thalassemia by flipping the switch back so that you have the non-sickling hemoglobin F. And the first attempts to do that were with medications. Next slide. So the reason why we have the switch has been worked out in some detail. There's a loop, and you can see in the middle there, there's a gamma, a G gamma and an A gamma. Those are our two gamma genes. And then there's a delta, and then there's our friend, the beta gene, which has the can have the mutation for sickle. There's a locus called the LCR. And in fetal life, it's parked over that gamma gene complex and facilitates the production of those globins. And then later in the third trimester, several proteins are upregulated, including this one BCL11A. And then that moves this locus control region from the gamma area over to the delta and the beta, and we have the switch. So you can see that you could switch this back to gamma if you eliminated the BCL11A. Next slide. So F has some other effects that are interesting. There's a glutamine in the 87th position. And when you have a molecule that includes a gamma and a beta S, it will prevent sickling. So it has a potent anti-sickling effect. We know that it's anti-sickling because you don't see disease until it's switched off. In large studies, high hemoglobin F levels predict a better outcome. A pediatrician, Dr. Watson, in 1948 showed that people who have this rare condition, the HbFH, don't have disease. And then we know that certain drugs will increase the hemoglobin F level. And after messing around with some pretty awful things, hydroxyurea turned out to be a very easy and relatively inexpensive way to increase hemoglobin F. And in 1996, we have the MESH trial showing a benefit from hydroxyurea. And that was that frequency of crises were diminished by 50%. And in a subsequent follow-up of that group, the people who were started on it first had an improved life expectancy. So right now, hydroxyurea is the only FDA-approved drug that improved life expectancy. And there's a big push to have as many people on hydroxyurea as we possibly can. The other thing about this mutation, this change, the glutamate and at the 87 position, is that if you want to make a gene to give to patients, you can take the hemoglobin beta gene and make this change and use this molecule, and it will have a better effect than if you use just a native beta globin because of this inhibition that this amino acid change confers on the sickling process. Next slide. As Ms. Gray mentioned, transplantation is a curative treatment, but it's only allogeneic that seems to be the best. And unfortunately, patients with sickle cell disease who are above the age of 18 don't fare well with allogeneic transplant. Kids under 16 do, and that's the preferred treatment. So gene therapy is going to be offered to kids over 12 who do not have a transplant donor. Now, there's been experience with many transplants, and I think that's what Ms. Gray talked about, and that is a potential line of treatment, and it's still under investigation. But as she mentioned, are you going to trade sickle cell disease for transplant-related morbidity, mortality, graft versus host disease is what she mentioned specifically. Next slide. Now, gene therapy is what we're talking about. And this is from a publication in Blood, and it simplifies things a great deal. But the first step is to have your stem cells mobilized. And that's not easy in sickle cell, actually. And then the second step is to put that in the Petri dish and do your genetic magic. In one case, you insert a gene, and so you end up with three beta genes. That inserted gene is randomly placed in the genome. In the case of CRISPR, you insert a RNA template and an enzyme, and you edit out the promoter for that BCL11A, and that goes away. And in those cells, they are permanently set to do F. Then those stem cells have to be put back in, but they're not going to do much if you have a marrow full of normal sickle cells, precursors. So the patient undergoes this term called conditioning, which is a mild way of saying you get everything obliterated with a big dose of busulfan. It's not as big a dose as you get for allogeneic transplant, but it's enough to wipe out the marrow and give living space for the new stem cells with the new gene program. Those are infused, and like she said, it's a quick process. It's basically a transfusion. Stem cells know where they need to go, and they go right to the marrow, and they set up shop. And 14 to, 2 weeks to 3 weeks later, you have a new marrow. And since it's your own cells, you have your own immune system. And so you're basically in pretty good shape. Next slide. This is a quick rundown on the two therapies. The first to be developed was gene addition. And this is a lentivirus that takes this altered hemoglobin beta chain and puts it randomly into the genome. It has a long name, but everybody calls it lovo-cel. It's from Bluebird. And the cost I've been hearing bandied about is $3.1 million for a single treatment. This is an ex vivo insertion of the chain. And after the autologous transplant with busulfan conditioning, you'll have anywhere from 27 to 63% of the hemoglobin changed to this beta chain that does that is not a sickling compound and also inhibits sickling. So patients seem to have had really good effects in most cases. They have greatly reduced vaso-occlusive episodes. Their hemoglobin corrects. There have been two problems, though, and that is if the product doesn't really take and the patient is still stuck with their own marrow, that marrow is in now growing up in a rather toxic environment of the busulfan conditioning, and there have been two cases of patients with leukemia or near leukemia related to this treatment, and it's not the genetic part of the treatment, but it's the busulfan conditioning regimen that seems to be the offender. Gene editing is a method based on the CRISPR-Cas-based system. And basically what Ms. Gray said is true. You're taking that big word salad that the genetic code is creating for us, and you're erasing one of those words. And that word is the promoter for that protein, BCL11A. So this is called exa-cel. Vertex is the company that developed it, and they are pricing theirs, I hear, at $2.2 million. The switch is reversed here, and it again involves autologous transplant with editing the edited cells after busulfan conditioning. And so far, in the 30 or 40 patients treated, just like the Bluebird product, they've seen a remarkable decrease in vaso-occlusive episodes, and they have improved hemoglobin. Next slide. So there are a lot of questions raised ethically about this. What does a cure mean? These are things that come up from the communities. Patients and caregivers have these questions. What does a cure mean? Will the treatment give me cancer? I've lived my whole life identified as a patient with sickle cell. How will a cure change this? How long will the therapy work? What happens if it stops? What if I'm not eligible to get the therapy? And then finally, my last slide, and this is my old slide, and you can see now that the landscape is, over the last 10 years, has become an incredibly new landscape of treatment opportunities with two basic types of curative therapy. Hematopoietic stem cell allogeneic transplant or gene therapy by addition or gene editing. Thank you.
Right. Thank you so much. First of all, let me say thank you to Dr. McGinn and to Common Spirit for this opportunity to be with you this morning and to hear again Miss Gray's amazing story, which becomes even more poignant, you know, when you hear it for a second time. So I would just like to quickly talk about some technical, ethical, and policy challenges that I think you already now have a good sense of as we move forward with these options to use these genetic interventions to try to address severe sickle cell disease. Next slide, please. So I just want to tell you a little bit more about CRISPR. You've probably heard about it a lot. The acronym comes from a phrase which describes very literally what researchers found in bacteria, which turned out to be a bacterial defense system to fight off the viruses that the bacteria encounter. And so it's clustered, regularly interspaced, short palindromic repeats. And if you want to look more into that, you can just use your search engine and all sorts of information will come up. But the key piece here was hijacking this bacterial defense mechanism gave us a new genetic editing technology. We had other ones before, but this one was cheaper, faster, more accurate, and even more efficient than any other method that we had had up to this point. So that was the real excitement. Next slide, please. Even though it is more accurate, there are still what we call the off-target edit concerns. And it's not that the CRISPR doesn't do what it's supposed to do. It's that it could do it somewhere else, targeting something less precisely as we would like. So I just give an example here. So for instance, if we took another gene that has single mutations in it, like cystic fibrosis, and let's call that cystic fibrosis gene the gene that assists breathing, because obviously it's a transmembrane protein in the lung epithelium. So if you have the most common cystic fibrosis mutation, which is the deletion of the 508 amino acid, the phenylalanine, you would like lose the E, for instance, in assist breathing. So now you have a gene that says assist breathing, which doesn't work, right? And so now you have, that leads to the disease of cystic fibrosis. So, okay, we use CRISPR now. We're going to look for any part of the genome that has BRATHING. And then we'll have CRISPR go in and insert an E where it's supposed to be, and that will fix the gene. And now it'll be back to being assist breathing rather than assist breathing. But what if also, in addition to that, your CRISPR targeting also finds another gene that it thinks has that same problem because it also has a BRACH or HING, but that one happens to be a nerve gene, which is assist branching. But CRISPR doesn't know. And if it's even off by just a little bit, it could go in and change that gene also. So you get the correct change that you want, but you also might get these what we call off-target edits. And so that is the concern because CRISPR-Cas9 is not 100% accurate. So just so you know, there are other CRISPR-Cas variants that are being developed that appear to be even more precise and more accurate. So when you take the cells out and you make these edits, oftentimes you have to go back in and check to see to make sure that there haven't been any off-target impacts. And that is something you can do by just sequencing the cells outside the body before they go back in. So it helps that the treatment is outside the body rather than in vivo, in the body itself. Next slide, please. However, even when you do a different approach, like the insertion of the gene that Dr. Udden talked about, which is putting a more normal or more functional gene in with the lentiviral vector, then the problem of the off-target piece is not necessarily the editing that's done. It's where the gene ends up when it goes in. And so we've already understood that there have been problems with this in the past with gene therapy. You may remember Jesse Gelsinger back in the late 1990s, who volunteered basically for an ornithine transcarbamylase gene therapy experiment because he had a moderate level of the disease. But as a young man, he wanted to be altruistic and sign up for this treatment. Unfortunately, he had a very strong immune reaction to the viral vector that was being used, which they did not know, they did not discover, I should say, ahead of time. However, even later, there was another experiment that was done in France for children with severe combined immune deficiency. And this is the bubble boy disease we all remember from the 1980s. So they took 20 children with this disease and they treated them with a gene therapy insertion of the functional adenosine deaminase gene, and then found out that 17 of the 20 children were successfully treated for the disease. Unfortunately, later, three of those 17 developed leukemia. And that was because the gene that put in the new healthy ADA gene inserted itself in front of another gene called LMN2, which is involved in gene regulation. And that's what led to the leukemia. So as Dr. Uden said, you have also the problem with the busulfan creating the problem of a cancer risk. But when you're putting in a new gene using some kind of viral vector, you also have to worry about where it inserts to see if it might disrupt some other gene or not. These are just all sort of technical challenges that we have to take into consideration when we're weighing whether or not to implement these particular treatments in, you know, light of other treatments that are possible. Okay, next slide, please. So looking at all that, this is from a website for the Institute for Clinical and Economic Review. I just want to make you aware of this. You can go to their website and look at their extensive analysis of these two genetic treatments, XSL and Lovo-cel, in addition to the cost. So I just want you to recognize the fact that in doing their analysis, they also talk to patients, their families, as well as all the medical people and the people from the companies that created these treatments, looking at all of these variables. And again, you can go to their website and get all the details, but I will just give you the general conclusions that they had were that both options, not necessarily at the price tag that Dr. Uden mentioned, because they would like it to come down a little bit, but if it, even if it came down to say 1.5 million, they think over the long term, both treatments for a certain subset of people with severe sickle cell disease, as we heard about from Ms. Gray, are certainly worth it, even at that elevated initial cost. So this is the challenge before us in trying to decide, okay, to get those long-term benefits, who do we decide gets this treatment, on what basis, and how do we address what might be an enormous cost up front in order to get those long-term benefits. Okay, next slide, please. To address some of this, the current administration, working with the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services and their Innovation Center, has come up with a model that they think could work in terms of trying to address that significant upfront cost in order to get those long-term benefits. And next slide, please. This is just a summation of their reasoning. But as you can see here on this slide, if you take into consideration the almost $3 billion per year cost of people with sickle cell disease and all the ancillary costs, and match the gene therapy treatments for that against that cost, you can see how this would be a financially responsible thing to do for the healthcare system. Now, the way they suggest this might be done would be to use the Medicaid system that already exists And so CMS would negotiate with the manufacturers for a reasonable cost so that the manufacturers are getting some money back to cover their costs, but it will be tied to positive outcomes. So we're making sure that only gets paid for when it works. Now, the element to their proposed approach that is somewhat tentative is that since it uses the Medicaid system, the states, which of course control the Medicaid within their own states, would have to voluntarily sign on to this. Now, of course, one can make the argument, as ICER did, that this would be long-term financially beneficial for all the states. But again, this is part of the process that we have in front of us going forward, because as you can see, this model is proposed to start in January of 2025, allowing the states to then sign on to participate, and they can do that all the way up until January 2026. So this is part of that challenge that is in front of us. Next slide, please. So I thank you very much. And if we have time for questions, I would love to engage in that conversation. Thank you.
Thank you, panelists. And now I'm going to invite Dr. Uddin and Ms. Gray to join us again. Absolutely riveting, phenomenal presentation. And I just want to lead with gratitude to all of the panelists for the incredibly thoughtful and moving comments that you've shared. Ms. Gray, let me begin with you. Absolutely incredible. As a pediatric intensive who many times in my career have cared for young people living with sickle cell disease, to hear your story is simply overwhelming. Thank you. Dr. Uddin, Father Fitzgerald, thank you for sharing your expertise. We know that we are at the end of time and really would like to be respectful of those who have other commitments. And so what we're committing to you is that we're going to come back to this conversation with a 5-minute check-in with Dr. McGinn. There are so many thoughtful points raised around access, opportunity, long-term implications of this treatment, reflections about what it means to the patient. How do we bring learning health systems together to achieve excellence and make sure that our patients are served in this way? And we want to do that conversation justice, and we can't do that in just a couple of minutes. And so we want to take this opportunity to say thank you to the panelists and the audience. Again, Ms. Gray, special appreciation to you for the extraordinarily personal and moving story and journey that you've shared. And we will look forward to coming back to all of you with a 5-minute check-in with Dr. McGinn to address the many questions and exciting dialogue around this very critical and important topic in healthcare. Thank you all so much for joining us today. A pleasure.